Lecture 12, Spring Holidays.
We're now moving from the fall holiday cycle to the spring holiday cycle. The first holiday we'll be discussing is Passover, or in Hebrew, Pesach. Now, the Exodus from Egypt serves as the archetype of redemption. According to the introduction to the Decalogues, both in Exodus and in Deuteronomy, we have the following introduction. I, the Lord, am your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. This idea of having been redeemed in the past becomes the precedent for redemption in the future. And the historical experience of the Exodus is rehearsed in many different rituals in the Jewish tradition. So, for instance, the liturgy reinforces the theme of God as the Redeemer of the Israelites. The blessings on Shabbat to sanctify the wine mention the Exodus from Egypt. And what's important about this period of transition is that the Israelites are no longer servants of Pharaoh. They're servants of God. The same word in Hebrew, slave, is also the word for servant. In antiquity, there wasn't the idea of a slave, at least in the Hebrew Bible, the way we think about a slave today, someone who forevermore is the property of a master. So a servant had the same idea, and in the Hebrew Bible, slaves were for a specific amount of time. They couldn't be made to work on the Sabbath. Right? So that's certainly something different than we would expect a slave master, say, in 1840 North Carolina, right, to grant to their slaves. The rabbis notice a peculiarity about the Hebrew Bible. If the story of the Exodus is the main drama of the Hebrew Bible, it's the main plot, then why wouldn't the word liberation or freedom be in the Hebrew Bible itself? That word is cherut. And nowhere in the Hebrew Bible does the word word freedom appear. So the rabbis, in a clever pun, say, oh, well, cherut doesn't appear, but charut does. Same letters, but different vowels. And remember, there are no vowels in the scroll of the Torah. What does charut mean? Engraved. And that word is used for the laws that are engraved on the two tablets in the Decalogue. So what are the rabbis trying to say? That it's not about freedom from oppression, but it's about freedom to dedicate yourself to something that you feel good about, that reflects your own sense of the world of justice, of righteousness, of morality. Not freedom from, but freedom to. And so liberty or freedom is really engraving or dedicating yourself to God's will. I'm reminded of that very poignant line sung by Janis Joplin, although written by Kris Kristofferson, freedom's just another name for nothing left to lose. That's freedom from. You don't have anything to lose when you're free in that sense. That's not the sense in which the Israelites were free, because they went from being servants of Pharaoh to servants of God. As I've said, this precedent for redemption from Egypt becomes the paradigm for future redemption for the people of Israel from their worldly woes, not from their individual transgressions. It's not about redemption from sin. It's about individual redemption of sin. It's not about that. What it is about is communal redemption so that the Israelites can live as a free people in their land and worship their God. Passover, or Pesach in the Torah, is described in Exodus 12, and the instructions that God gives to Moses are as follows. On the 10th day of the first month, right, this is a spring holiday, so now we're in the first month, right? No longer in the seventh month. We're in the first month. The 10th day of the first month, each family should take a lamb. Guard it until the 14th day of the month, and then slaughter it. Take some of the blood and dab it on the doorposts and lintel of your homes. The lintel is the top piece of wood on your door. Then you're supposed to eat the lamb with unleavened bread, that's matzah, and bitter herbs. Now, this meal becomes the Seder, right? Seder is a Hebrew word that means order, and it describes the order of events that you're supposed to engage in for the ritual describing or recounting the Passover Exodus. That's on in Israel. You only have one Seder on the first night of Passover. But outside the land of Israel, because you celebrate two holidays, you have two Sedarim, which is the plural for Seder. So if you didn't talk about something in the first Seder, you have an opportunity to do it again on the second night and eat twice as much matzah. Now let's read a few verses from Exodus 12. Moses said to them, "Go slaughter the Pesach offering, the Passover offering, take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that is in the basin, and apply some to the two doorposts. For when the Lord goes through to smite the Egyptians," the firstborn of the Egyptians, that was the final plague, "for when the Lord goes through to smite the Egyptians, he will see the blood, and the Lord will pass over the door." The Lord will pass over the door. That's how we get the name Passover, right? God didn't kill the firstborn of the Israelite males, only the firstborn of the Egyptian males. Some people think that this verse is the source for why Jews have something called a mezuzah on their doorposts. Well, that is certainly not how the rabbis understood the mezuzah. Here are two examples of mezuzot, the plural of mezuzah. They're about 3 inches tall, and they contain within them a scroll. So the word mezuzah in the Hebrew Bible means doorposts. In rabbinic Hebrew, the word mezuzah came to mean not doorposts, but the actual scroll that contains several different sections of the Hebrew Bible, including that section from Deuteronomy 6 that says, "And you shall bind these on the doorposts of your home." So this has the Shema, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one," and a few verses down, and then another couple of sections. This is a mezuzah. Some people today in the Jewish community sometimes make the mistake of thinking that the mezuzah case is the mezuzah. The mezuzah case can be made of any material. It can be glass, as this one is. It can be metal, as those were. It can be ceramic. My roommate, a couple of years ago, wanted to make the point that you don't need a mezuzah case at all. So what he did is wrap up the mezuzah itself, the cloth, the piece of parchment that these sections from the Torah are written on. He wrapped it up into saran wrap, and he taped it to his door. And he had fulfilled his obligation. In traditional Jewish homes, you don't just see a mezuzah on the doorpost of their home, but on every single door, except for the bathroom, in their house. So you'll know, and even cultural Jews that don't have a strong identification with Jewish religion and Jewish ritual, I would say most cultural Jews still have a mezuzah on their home as a means of identification. But that's not what the blood on the doorpost here signifies. Pesach, as in the English word paschal, can be translated as Passover. Correct. But it was also translated by some of the earliest translators of the Torah into Aramaic, which was the language that was spoken during the rabbinic period, as protect. Not Passover, but protect. With this reading, the holiday, or the word Pesach, is not an exemption from divine justice that was meted out to those people that had been persecuting the weak and the vulnerable, namely the Jews, but rather is an expression of divine protection and mercy for those who have been persecuted and oppressed. So depending on how you translate that word, Pesach, it gives a very different understanding to what God's actions and intentions were in that historical moment. The Pesach Haggadah is the script that Jews use on the first or second nights of Passover in order to recount the telling of the Exodus from Egypt. The word Haggadah means retelling or telling, and it is related to the word Agadah, which is the opposite of Halacha, Jewish law. The Haggadah retells the rabbinic version of the Exodus from Egypt. So although there are biblical quotations, the rabbis employ that traditional means of midrash in order to flesh out the story. The Haggadah can also be read as a coded text exploring political rebellion against the Romans, who then occupied the land of Israel. Let me give you an example. One of the biblical texts that the rabbis then interpret is, my father was a wandering Aramean, from the end of Deuteronomy. My father was a wandering Aramean in the plain contextual sense means my father Abraham was born in Padan Aram, and he left Aramea and eventually made it to the land of Canaan that is now the land of Israel. It's about journey, it's about quest, it's about seeking. But the rabbis reinterpret the words in order to mean Laban is the Aramean, was trying to destroy my father. Right? Laban, the Aramean, and Laban indeed is an Aramean. Laban is the brother of Rebekah and the father of Leah and Rachel, and the patriarchs end up marrying Rebekah, Rachel, and Leah. So Laban is trying to destroy my father. What's going on there? Well, Laban the Aramean, if you take the words Arami, which mean Aramean, and you twist them around, Arami becomes Ramai. Arami becomes Ramai. And Ramai are the Romans. The Romans are trying to destroy my father. In other words, the rabbis may have used this example of past redemption from oppression in Egypt as a way to talk about present redemption from Roman occupation and Roman persecution. And so the Aramean there becomes a code for the Romans. Now, the lack of support for messianic activity, and remember what messianic activity means, reestablishing Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, may be seen in the bizarre absence within the Haggadah of the human hero of the Exodus, Moses, as we mentioned before. Now, on this holiday, Passover is a seven-day holiday, there are certain dietary prohibitions. In particular, five grains are prohibited from consumption and ownership during Passover. They are wheat, barley, spelt, oats, and rye. Anything made from those five grains and coming into contact with water and then baking for over 18 minutes, is called chametz. It is leavened, and it is forbidden to eat, and it is forbidden to own on Passover. Now, in the Middle Ages, the Jews from Europe, those were the Ashkenazi Jews from France and from Germany and Poland, those are the Ashkenazi Jews. Ashkenaz means German, but you didn't have to live in Germany in order to be an Ashkenazi Jew. They also prohibited eating small things. The way to say small things in Hebrew is kitniot. Katan is small. So kitniot were little things like rice and peas and beans. The explanation that I've heard that makes the most sense to me for why kitniot, or those small things, were also prohibited to Ashkenazi Jews is because when the Jews would go, when anybody would go, to the marketplace in order to buy grains, the salesperson would have a scoop, and the different grains and the different peas and beans would be next to each other in burlap sacks. And so let's say somebody wanted a bag of lentils. Well, you would scoop the lentils into the bag, but who's to say that the previous customer didn't want, a kilogram of rye, and that in the process of putting the rye into the person's bag, a few specks of rye dropped into the lentils, so that when you were now giving the Jew the lentils on Passover, it contained a few specks of one of those forbidden grains. So the rabbis, in order to be safe rather than sorry, and because there's no room for error in Passover, as there is at other times of the year, I'll talk about that in a second, the rabbis prohibited all kitniot, all small things that might be in those burlap sacks at the open-air market. In the Sephardic world that was populated by Jews that had been exiled from Spain or who lived in North Africa or the Middle East, they didn't have any such prohibition, and Sephardic Jews continue to eat kitniot to this day. During the year, we know that there's a prohibition against eating milk and meat together. But let's say that I'm cooking a meat stew, and my 2.5-year-old daughter is running around the kitchen with a glass of milk, and she trips, and a speck of milk falls into the meat stew. I don't have to dump the entire meat stew as long as the quantity of milk that entered the meat pot is less than 1/60th. right? That was the measure that was used by the rabbis to constitute a significant amount. But there's no 1/60th leeway on Passover. You're not supposed to have even a speck, even a trace of this leavened product. Now, we talked about the connection between spirit and law. Already in the rabbinic period, the rabbis make a connection between the yeast that causes the forbidden grains to rise with the inclination to do evil that is in each one of us, that causes us to be puffed up and haughty and arrogant and to rise up against God's will. So that 6 months after Yom Kippur, the rabbis understand Pesach to be yet another opportunity to clean out the chametz, the leavening, the pride, the arrogance, the haughtiness of our own lives. And that's why we can't even own chametz during this period. During the rest of the year, it's good to have a little bit of pride. It's good to have a good self-esteem and a good self-image. But we are commanded during Passover to view ourselves as if we were slaves coming out of the land of Egypt. Well, one of the problems with being slaves is that your spirit has been crushed. And so in order to spiritually recreate that sense of a crushed spirit, we're not even supposed to have a trace of that pride or self-esteem for that period during Passover in order to really feel as though we had been released from bondage in the land of Israel by God's mighty hand and outstretched arm. After the 7-day period of Passover is over, there is an eighth day of Passover, that then in the diaspora becomes a 9th day. But beginning already on the second night, we start counting every day, every night, depends on when you want to count. But traditional Jews count as soon as the sun is set. This is the first day after Passover. This is the second day after Passover. That period is called the Omer. The reason why they're counting is because 49 days after the Passover is when we celebrate the Pentecost, or 50 days, which in Hebrew is called Shavuot. What does Shavuot mean in Hebrew? It means weeks. So there are 7 weeks. So, right, as soon as the first day of Passover is over, you start counting with the anticipation of what Shavuot commemorates, which is the receiving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. So Jews are commanded to count each of those days in anticipation of Shavuot. Now, the first 33 days of that period, that entire period is called the Omer. And the Omer literally means a sheaf of barley. But here we're talking about the period where the barley holiday, the barley harvest, is what's celebrated also at Shavuot, combining the natural and the historical once again. But during the first 33 days of the Omer, the period has a somewhat somber and semi-mourning tone to it. The Talmud says that 24,000 of Rabbi Akiva's students died during this period due to a lack of respect for one another. The historical memory might also include the Hadrianic persecutions surrounding the Bar Kokhba revolt. Rabbi Akiva was one of the very few rabbis to support Bar Kokhba as the Messiah against the Roman occupation. And there was a 3-year period where there was something like Jewish independence again. We even have coins that were minted during that period that say this is the first year of Jewish liberation. Some of these coins were found by Yigal Yadin, a famous Israeli archaeologist, several decades ago in the caves in the Dead Sea area in the south of Israel. So it's customary not to get married during this period, or not to celebrate with music or dancing, and to not get one's haircut. The first 33 days traditionally tended to have a mournful tone. In the last 55 or 60 years, there have been a number of other days that the Israeli governments have instituted in that Omer period in order to recognize milestones within the history of the Jewish state. So on the 12th day of the Omer, Jews worldwide commemorate Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura, the day of catastrophe and heroism, otherwise known as Holocaust Remembrance Day. The Israeli Knesset, which is their parliament, they established this day in 1951. Today, there are a handful of Jews that mark that day, not only through remembering those Jews that gave their life, the 6 million Jews that gave their life during the Holocaust, but also by fasting. Fasting is a traditional way of experiencing a day of memory, a day of mourning. And so there are some contemporary Jews that have started the tradition of mourning on Holocaust Remembrance Day as well. Exactly 1 week later, on the 19th day of the Omer, the mournful mood continues with Yom HaZikaron, Israeli Memorial Day, commemorating Israel's fallen soldiers as well as those civilians who have been killed in terrorist incidents. In what is a terribly difficult transition for some, the 20th day of the Omer, immediately after Israeli Memorial Day, celebrates Yom HaAtzma'ut. Now, again, we have this day of celebration within the first 33 days of the Omer. So some very religious Jews, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, they don't recognize this day. They think that it shouldn't be celebrated in this 33-day period of the Omer. But the majority of the Jewish population in Israel and the majority of the Jewish population outside of Israel celebrates the 20th day of the Omer as Yom HaAtzma'ut, Independence Day, when Ben-Gurion proclaimed the birth of the modern state of Israel on May 14th, 1948. In this case, it wasn't an arbitrary date. It actually is the anniversary of Ben-Gurion's proclamation of independence for the modern state of Israel. Now, on this 33rd day of the Omer, that's called Log Ba'Omer. Log is just another way in Hebrew to say 33. That was a traditional day of celebration after this period of semi-mourning. So bonfires were traditionally lit, and children played with bows and arrows in the forest. Playing with bows and arrows might also go back to the Jewish resistance of the Romans during the Bar Kokhba revolt. Weddings that had been deferred during the Omer can now take place. People get their haircuts. And the day is also associated with one of Rabbi Akiva's star pupils, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Today, thousands and thousands of people go to Mount Meron up in the north in Israel, near Tzfat or Safed in northern Israel, to celebrate Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's Yahrzeit. What is a Yahrzeit? Yahrzeit is a Yiddish word that means the anniversary of that person's death. Judaism doesn't celebrate someone's birthday after they've passed away. They celebrate someone's death day. I think that there is an understanding that when we're born, everybody's equal. Everybody has potential to do lots of wonderful things and lots of not so wonderful things with their life. So when you celebrate someone's Yahrzeit, you're actually celebrating not their potential, as you might on their birthday, but you're celebrating their accomplishments and the history of what they've done. The next day within the Omer that is celebrated is the 43rd day. That is Yom Yerushalayim, or Jerusalem Day. And that occurred on June 7th, 1967, during the Six-Day War, when the old city of Jerusalem fell under Jewish control for the first time in 2,000 years. And so this is a day of celebration within Israel and outside of Israel for the Jewish community. Although, certainly, when we think about the Arab world, who consider the establishment of Israel as a Nakba, or a catastrophe, this is certainly not a day of celebration for that community. We count 49 days after Passover, and then on the 50th day is Shavuot, or the Pentecost. Now, unlike Sukkot and Pesach, which combine natural harvests and historical events in the drama of the Israelite experience, the biblical understanding of Sukkot is only a harvest holiday for barley. Nowhere in the Torah does it say that it was on this day of Shavuot, of Pentecost, that God spoke to the children of Israel at Mount Sinai. That was something that the rabbis then projected onto the day hundreds of years later, again, in order to have each of the three pilgrimage holidays, Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuot, represent both harvest holidays of nature and historical moments in the Jewish experience in antiquity. So rabbinic tradition assigns historical significance to this day, and in the rabbinic imagination, Shavuot represents the marriage between God and the Jewish people. Moses was the best man. Mount Sinai was the chuppah, or the wedding canopy. The name Shavuot, which we said means weeks, with a slight change of vowels, can be pronounced as Shavuot, or oaths, as in wedding oaths. So in the rabbinic imagination, this is the day when Moses, the best man, leads the children of Israel, the bride, underneath the wedding canopy at Mount Sinai, to marry God, the groom. The witnesses are heaven and earth, and the ketubah, or the marriage contract, is the Torah itself, which is why in some Sephardic and Yemenite communities, there's a poetic ketubah, this marriage contract, that is actually read in synagogue on Shavuot, right? This very nice image of perhaps what for most of us is the most emotionally intense moment of our lives is then projected on to what must have been the most emotionally intense moment in the lives of the Israelites, that revelation at Mount Sinai. In terms of the books that are read, or the readings that we have in synagogue for the holiday of Shavuot, the book of Ruth is read for two reasons. A, because it is set during the barley harvest, so it corresponds to what the Torah describes the holiday of Shavuot, or the sixth day of Sivan, in the Hebrew months celebrating, but also because what does Ruth do? Ruth takes on the Torah herself. In rabbinic vision, she's the first convert to Judaism. It's a slightly different story if we take a look at Ruth in context, but from the rabbinic imagination, Ruth is the first convert, and indeed many of the laws of conversion, the rabbis glean from the book of Ruth itself. So Ruth accepts the Torah as the Jewish people accepted the Torah at Mount Sinai. So there's a nice parallel there. In the medieval period, a custom arose that is first described in the Zohar, which is the Bible of Jewish mysticism, probably written in the late 13th century in Spain, although it's attributed to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, whose Yahrzeit, whose the anniversary of his death, we celebrate on Lag BaOmer in that northern city, in that mountain, Har Meron, outside of Tzfat. So in the Zohar, it talks about a tikkun lel shavuot, which means staying up all night in order to study, staying up all night studying in order to be ready first thing in the morning to receive the Torah, just like our ancestors in the Bible received the Torah in the morning. Actually, the rabbis understand that the Israelites slept through their alarm clock that morning, and Moses had to kind of go around to the tents and wake them up. So in order to serve as a tikkun, or as a repair, as a fix for what happened, what the rabbis imagined, happened to the ancient Israelites, they want to stay up all night, and they want to study Torah in order to be ready for that first moment of dawn, of light, of redemption, of revelation, to correspond to what the ancient Israelites experienced at Mount Sinai. Now, it turns out that this idea of staying up all night long during a religious holiday was probably modeled after the Easter vigils that the Spanish Jews saw the Spanish Christians doing in Spain, and they thought, that's a great idea, let's absorb that custom ourselves. The idea didn't become widespread until the 16th or 17th century, and very interestingly, that's exactly the time when coffee beans made their way to the land of Israel, where this custom was really promoted and became much more widespread. So as people drank coffee for the first time, it was easier for more and more people to stay up all night and not pass out first thing in the morning, but to be awake and to stand in correspondence to the Israelites standing at Mount Sinai. So this custom was long popular only amongst mystically inclined groups, but has become more widespread in the last generation. So in many of the cities in the United States now, Boston, New York, Los Angeles, there are literally dozens of Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox synagogues that advertise a long list of speakers to keep people awake and entertained to some degree as well all night long so that they can have a sunrise morning service and take in Shavuot, this holiday, right at the dawn of light, right at the revelation of light. Okay, that concludes our description of the holidays in the spring cycle. Our next lecture will conclude our discussion of holiness and time by looking at historically minor holidays that aren't so minor these days.